ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. And let me now very warmly welcome Jack Waterford, who's undoubtedly a household name in Canberra. I think he's held just about every post in the Canberra Times you like to name. He's now editor at the large, which I think means that we can read him on about five pages on most days. For me, it's always a refreshing read. Jack is a law graduate and has been at some stage editor-in-chief of the Canberra Times. He's won awards for his journalism. He's one of the most prolific journalists in the country. And he was awarded an award of the Order of Australia for his particular advocacy, investigative journalism, and his commitment to Indigenous affairs. I always think that Jack's articles are most interesting when he starts to write about Indigenous affairs, because I know it's an issue that's very close to his own heart. His talk today is the media and human rights. Thanks very much, Jack.
I'm not going to talk for very long because the questions you ask and the dialogue, I think, is always much more interesting than anything I've directly got to say. But I just sort of wanted to start off with a few general observations about journalism switching into human rights and social justice sort of issues. One of them is sort of slightly against the context that many of you will know that there's a strike on in the Fairfax organisation. And I'll raise something like that. But I might just start by talking a little bit about Canberra and why it's a special and a very interesting place, and why some people like me hope that it's out of places like this that some of the future of the media is going to be determined. Now, I don't have to tell you that Canberra are terribly special people. Canberra contains very special people, and Canberra is a very special place. But it reflects itself in a number of significant demographic ways that are very important in terms of the medium. Willy-nilly, we're called upon to govern the rest of the country, not just as public servants, but as often as not as academics, the diplomatic establishment, the media, the lobbying industries, and so forth like that. But information is one of the primary ingredients of knowing what's going on. I was just remarking to John Langmore that in spite of the previous greatness of the age, and to some extent some capacity to retrieve it, it's quite remarkable if you go down to Melbourne how parochial the age is and how inwardly focused it is. I think I first noticed this about 30 years ago as a northerner with no interest whatever in Aussie rules, but a casual interest at best in various forms of rugby. And you could read the age for a whole year without knowing that that any codes of rugby existed. Likewise, you could read the Sydney Morning Herald and not know that what was then called VFL existed. For one reason or another, Canberra was not just a meeting ground for people from all over, but it actually was on a fault line where some of these social divides are. And before there was, say, an AFL, heaven help the Canberra Times if on Monday morning we didn't have the Western Australian club results, because there are over 1,000 people in Canberra who came from Perth who were still quite closely involved in it. There's supposedly always an argument occurring at the Canberra Times about localism versus nationalism and so forth, and it's generally a quite wrong sort of argument, because while we do intensely debate all of these sorts of things all the time, there's just no doubt that a very high proportion of our audience are looking outwards of Canberra all the time to find out what's going on, what affects them in their work, what affects them in their conversations and whatnot. About 40% of the readers of the Canberra Times take at least two other newspapers. And they don't take other newspapers because the Canberra Times by itself is unsatisfactory. In fact, one of the pleasing things about almost everybody who does multiple newspaper purchases in the ACT is that the Canberra Times is a part of their package. Sometimes, rather than congratulate ourselves on it, I remind people that that's probably because the Canberra Times is the only place that tells you what's on the pictures. And there we can't take that entirely for granted. But the very same people who are reading so many newspapers every day are the very same people who've now got, say, pay television and turn on CNN or BBC News early on in the morning, who listen to AM as they are going to work, who when they get to work click on to the internet for news and information oriented sites, and the research now suggests that people of this ilk are doing so three or four times a day during their working day, let alone what they might do at night, are listening to the midday ABC and to PM, and they're also listening to radio. In fact, they're very adept users of all of the media, and they know perfectly well the relative advantages of each. The immediacy of radio, the capacity of the internet to home in on things, the fact that at least in theory newspapers have got, if you like, some thinking time where they ought to be able to weigh events and set them in some sort of context and give you a bit of history and background that can't be given immediately with the breathiness of a radio report. The fact that television has got pictures and that images are often quite valuable. I never fear in that sort of context of things that the print media is ultimately going to lose out in relation to the internet or to other broadcast media, because those most news-hungry and information-hungry people are going to be sensibly taking information from wherever they can get it according to what it's about. What we really have to worry about is that there's a whole array of people out there in the world who are more and more switched off from this. And they're not just not taking newspapers, but increasingly they're not consuming other media as well. Or if they are consuming other media, it is not primarily for current news, information, understanding of what's going on. Now, sometimes when people predict the demise, the ultimate demise of newspapers, they will point to something like the fact that in Australia the great broadsheet newspapers have run on what many people call the rivers of gold, classified advertising revenue. You pick up the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age, even a strike edition produced today, and you practically need a forklift truck to bring it inside your house. And it is said that that sort of advertising is going to decline. And why? Well, if you want to buy a house, say for example, instead of looking at the Canberra Times and sort of going down the thing, you can sort of say, I want a three-bedroom house on the north side of the lake, no more than $500,000 and close to a school or something, and you can get it. You call up the house, you can look on the plans of the house, you can see if there's any planning restrictions over the area, you can look at house sales in your street, house sales in the suburb, trends, a whole host of things. All things that a newspaper can't quite do. Well, that's true up to a point. And there are successful internet people there, even ones that we don't have any association with. We're actually on the internet in that sort of marketplace ourselves. But one of the points about it is that of the people who are going to buy houses in Canberra in the next month, half of them don't actually realise right now that they're in the housing market. But they're voracious readers of our domain section because they like to perv. They look through the papers to sort of see what sort of houses are on, to confirm their own good impression of the value of their house and the way that it's standing up and so forth like that. And suddenly somebody sort of says, oh, I think I might stroll down the road and have a look at that house that's up for sale. And an amazing number of people buy that way. Likewise, if you look at, say, the Sydney Morning Herald, you'll see that the real money that's being made these days is not so much from the classified advertising at the back of the jobs market, which are essentially jobs for relatively unskilled people, but other jobs that are up in the front of the paper. And they're advertisements which are focused not at somebody who's out of a job or who's looking for work or who's long-term unemployed or in some way disadvantaged in the job market. These are ads that are focused at people who are comfortable and snug in the jobs that they've got at the moment, aren't looking on the internet or anywhere else for new jobs, but they read page 5 of the Canberra Times or the Sydney Morning Herald and they say, how hell. There's a job just right up my street and it's paying $20,000 more a year. And they'd shaken out of their comfort zone and apply for it and whatnot. And that is where the major skills shortages and employment potential is in Australia at the moment, and newspapers are at the moment one of the few ways in which you can draw the existence of such jobs to public attention. I fear that, sorry, I don't fear, I suspect that that will always be so. So, I don't sort of think that we're going to see the last newspaper on the 1st of January 1943, sorry, 2043, as somebody predicts. But I do very much fear for the industry because we are in a state of great change at the moment, and we are increasingly under the rules of accountants and market people, and we are seeing a considerable decline in the resources that are going into journalism, some of which is sharpened by beliefs that the media is sort of slowly going out of business and that we'll be all taken over by the internet or something. You can see this at the Canberra Times, and of course, while I have said these sort of things in public, I'm talking to you more intimately than rather than making a public exposition of my view on the current strike. But when the Rural Press Organisation took over the Canberra Times about 11 years ago, the Canberra Times was travelling reasonably comfortably. It's always been a quite profitable little paper. And it had about 100 journalists working on it, and journalists like public servants are paid in grades. And the average grading of a journalist at the Canberra Times was probably about 8, which suggested something between 10 and 15 years of professional experience. Now, since that takeover, the number of staff in the editorial department has not declined. But the average grading of journalists there now is about 3, which is to say about 5 years, I suppose, of professional experience on average, and that's taking into account that there is the odd old codger around like myself whose amount of professional experience is getting pretty close to 40 years. The kids who are writing the Canberra Times, and they are kids, are very, very bright, probably brighter than the cohort of people I joined with, but they've been out of university on average about 1 year, 2 years. They have very little experience, very little history, and a very large number of them have very little actual direct affiliation with Canberra. We're in a position at the moment, for example, where there are only 3 reporters on our staff who were on our staff. This, reporters is not the whole set of journalists, by the way. It's only about half of them. But who were around at the time of the last ACT election. And they will be going in to cover the next ACT election without any, if you like, clan memory or house memory of the Carmel government or the Follett government or anything like that. Of course, they've got many more tools to research it and to check it out, not least Google, and much more extensive library and electronic facilities than ever there were. But I'm beginning to think that we're starting to be at quite a marked disadvantage when we have let go particularly what I call our middle, but people of a good deal of experience, some capacity to form judgments and not a little capacity to sort of say, oh, we've seen all this before, oh, yes, this happened so and so, or who have watched trends in public administration or society occur over phases. We've just had major announcements this week in the education debate. I think one can fairly generally say that in education almost everything moves around in cycles, and at one moment everything is focused on preparing a better, more economic man fit for the labour market, and then we go round to the other side where it's all about education for education's sake, and we're in a continual switch about that. Well, as it happens, we've got an education reporter who's pretty much seen those sort of cycles around and has quite a body of experience. But an awful lot of the breathless commentary that we've been reading in the last few days has been written by people who have only been around in a very small part of the cycle and don't seem to have the research experience to understand that we've been through nearly all of this before. It was in 1998, I think, that at the press gallery, the elite group of journalists, or self-thought elite group of journalists who cover federal politics, which is the great staple of news in any paper, where over half of the federal press gallery had not been working in the press gallery during the time of the Keating government. I predict that we'll reach that point in relation to the Howard government probably towards the middle of next year. Now, in reorganising facilities this way and losing so much memory or something like that, journalism is seriously threatening to cut its own throat. Because the thing that journalism, the thing that print journalism can do so well, which is give more detail, give more analysis, set things into context, etc., is going to disappear if it's just written by bright, adept, fast, clever, admittedly, but ahistorical people who just aren't capable, at least at this stage of their professional development, of setting things in context. There's another point here which I think is perfectly illustrated by this audience. The average reader of a newspaper these days is aged about 45. Now, that's not actually all that greatly different from the average age of the population. I think the median age of the population is now around about 40. But there's no doubt that our solid and our most established readers are people in their 40s, 50s and 60s, and we're finding it more and more difficult to attract younger readers, as a result of which a lot of newspapers are doing all sorts of things to prove that they're with it and clever and that they're on the wave of the new generation, and occasionally hear people saying cynical things like, well, our real long-term problem, of course, is that our readers are dying off and we're not replacing them fast enough, or something like that. The truth is, our readers aren't actually dying off at a very fast rate. Our readers are actually very interested in what's happening in the world and are very engaged with what's happening in the world. And as it happens, particularly in a place like Canberra, they're also, most of them, reasonably comfortable, well-paid, spend a lot of money, are quite attractive to advertisers and capable of sustaining great profits in the newspapers. But the relentless search by newspaper managements to, if you like, get with it and be, you know, right for young people and whatnot is turning off an incredible number of our older readers, not satisfying them, and to some extent it seems that people don't really care. There's a wonderful newspaper in England, by the way, I don't know if any of you have ever seen it, it's a magazine, not a newspaper, but called The Oldie, which is focused on the idea that the typical reader of it is not young, with a trendy, massively consumerist or something like that, but is reasonably comfortable, settled. I would say traditionalist, but I don't mean by that politically conservative. In fact, the politics of it are what you might call Guardian readership level rather than whatnot. But who are not, if you like, eternally in search of new sensations, the latest trends or anything like that, but they're just ordinary, decent people who want to be well informed about what's going on in the world. It occasionally has jokes about itself. For example, rather than running an obituary column, it runs a column in which it interviews older people, and the headline over it is "Still with us." But it would be quite wrong to think that it was focused, if you like, at people who were just sort of about to teeter off the edge. It's about recognising, if you like, that plenty of people have got a contribution to make or an observation to make about the state of society or whatnot, who are over the age of 40, perhaps. And my dream for a paper like the Canberra Times is not that we become self-consciously staid or whatnot, but that we recognise that the core of our readership is older, wiser, very interested in what's going on in the world. And I actually suspect that an awful lot of the younger people in the community will then come back to newspapers when they realise that newspapers are again taking their readers seriously, giving them the sort of information that they want and that they need, and are not devoting so much of their space to mindless lifestyle material, the relentless pursuit of new consumer items, particularly in markets like cars, computers, telecommunications technology, and the relentless pursuit of sort of faux celebrities who are famous primarily for being famous. People like Britney Spears or Paris Hilton or various people like that, who I can't complain I don't know of. It's impossible to know anything about them, but I've still never actually worked out what any of them do. Apart from their underwear-wearing habits. Anyway, that's one piece of the background. A couple of other sort of things, and then I'll sort of sit down and talk questions. I joked in the paper not so long ago that the Canberra Times policy on religious matters was taken from Mencken's out of the Baltimore Sun, which was, we respect every man and every woman religion, but only in the same way that we respected their theory that their wife is very beautiful and that their children are above average. We are not an agnostic paper, but we're not a paper, we are a secular paper, and we report a whole host of streams of ideas, and we try in weighing, just as we try to in weighing, you know, national, local, international news or whatnot, but to streams of thought and ideas that are flowing about the community get assessed in the in much the same way as anything else. The Canberra audience is markedly liberal in and curious in what's going on in the world, and there is quite a bit of discussion of ethics, professional responsibility, religious matters and whatnot, and there's also a certain amount of casual news in it. But it would be idle to pretend that the proportion of it wasn't declining. And I would say generally that's because it is becoming less and less important in ordinary human conversation, in dialogue, whatnot. That may be a good thing, it may be, I'm pretty sure it's a bad thing, but every now and again when I try to crank things up a little bit on this thing, because I actually think that readers are particularly suckers, if you like, in the battle of ideas, and that good journalism about ideas and competing streams of thought always gets very good readership. And every now and again I even think of a conservative old way of doing it. When I was a young person, for example, the Sydney Morning Herald on a Monday morning would always have an Around the Churches column in which they would summarise four or five of the finer sermons which had been delivered in the Sydney Archdiocese. And quite often this would attract the odd letter to the editor, usually by zealots sort of seeking for heresies in other faiths or sometimes in their own. But it was actually interesting and most of it was fairly thoughtful. Any suggestions that I had that we might try such a thing actually were greeted with the most appalled looks on the behalf of some of the journalists. But even when I said, no, we'll short-circuit it, we'll approach some of the pastors, the preachers, the ministers and so forth and see if we can get copies of their notes or something so that it can be more or less done on the sub-editor's table, it was quite obvious that there wasn't a vast amount of interest in it, and in particular that the quality of preaching going on in most of this community was not particularly very high. I don't think, for example, that there's a Catholic cleric in Canberra of whose preaching one would write home. The best preacher in Canberra that I've heard, I should think, would be James O'Hare, who I would think is a world standard. But apart from that, it is very sort of difficult to sort of to say or to argue. I must say, incidentally, I don't go to enough to really form judgments of this, but to say or to argue that we ought to be doing more about it is not yet based on the thing that you might call, if you like, coffee discussion of, have you heard what so-and-so was saying, thing, or people coming back and talking about it, or people talking about how in a particular area everybody was discussing something that had been said. Instead, if we were to do it, I'm afraid sometimes it would fall within the sort of stream of worthy things that we ought to do more about, like cover more women in sport or something like that, when there's no particular evidence, if you like, of a strong market demand for it. Nonetheless, if people aren't directly involved and talking about, perhaps even demanding discussion on matters of faith, it's very clear that people, particularly in this community, are very, very interested in matters of social justice, in ways in which people relate to each other, in higher meanings in things, in questions of ethics, in questions of the right thing to do, in questions of how people organise themselves around collective ideas. And you can see this, you don't have to look for a thing, you can see this in some of the great public policy debates that we've had in the past decade, and particularly, I suppose, over questions such as refugee rights, over Aboriginal affairs generally, and perhaps more sharply in recent times over issues such as the intervention, and in a whole host of sort of questions about the way the community organises and deals with some of our underclasses and problems of education and so forth. There's a very active correspondence in it. I remember during the time of the Tampa crisis, when I kept being told confidently, particularly by Labor Party people who I thought had in particular affected a great betrayal of the Australian community, that I was saying, look, we know that, but the truth is that the public is very, very hostile to both people, refugees and so forth. We've got to keep the lid on it. And anyway, it's not the way in which we can win this election, which is going to be on this, you know, the small target philosophy is right. And there was sort of, we were told there was any amount of public opinion poll evidence showing this massive hostility in the population. Well, if that was so, I never saw very much evidence of it in Canberra. I think the Tampa crisis, for example, brought to the Canberra Times something like 1,000 letters to the editor. I can't think that more than about 15 of them would go so far even to support the Labor Party principle on it, let alone the Liberal Party principle on it. We saw as well, John Langmore might remember this ruefully or perhaps with a little bit of a smile, that when it came to the actual election itself, that of people who were closely attached to the Labor Party in the ACT, more than half of the formal members of the Labor Party did not vote for the Labor Party in that election. Most of them have not yet come back to voting first for the Labor Party, in spite of the fact that the voting Fraser, say for example, is back to John Langmore levels. So I always retain, if you like, an optimism that the actual human spirit, at least as it's manifest in Canberra, is actually rather more liberal on these sorts of issues. But one thing that I am quite certain about is that people are talking about it, people are quite interested about it, and I suppose particularly great from my point of view as a working journalist and as an ex-editor, is that they're also very engaged about it, very knowledgeable about it, wanting to be involved in it, and so forth. I joke often that this is one of the great cities of experts in the world. But, you know, there are experts here on Icelandic languages and the chemical makeup of almost every compound and so forth, and that if you ever say something in the Canberra Times like, this is the first time it's happened, but, 10 people will have rung in by 8:30 to say, no, it's not, it's happened 5 times before, and they'll be right. We have letters to the editor correcting other correspondents' Sanskrit that happened about 2 weeks ago. And this is, if you like, a measure of the fact that we're not just a great city of public administration and public service, but a great city of academia, of diplomacy, and military studies and a whole host of things like that. But it's also a reflection of the fact that not only are people, if you like, needing to be professionally engaged in it, they're interested in it, they love it, they believe it. In this sort of context, you know, is the media doing enough to lead it on? Well, I'd observe that most of the media, most of the mainstream media in Australia are what you might call forum-oriented. Even papers which are, if you like, papers of very strong view, the Australian, say, for example, are actually reasonably Catholic in the range of views that they allow into the paper, and particularly in their news columns. Most of the other mainstream papers actually are fairly good at presenting views on pretty well all sides of the spectrum. There are sometimes when there are some people who, if you like, want the paper to be full of only one thing, which is, if you like, a worthy thing going on at the moment. But I think that myself, that while sometimes we ought to focus more sharply on some particularly important issues going on, that we've got to respect the intelligence of their readers and their understanding that they can appreciate about 50 or 60 things going on at once, and the need to do it, and in many cases people can sharpen down and focus on it. So I'm not particularly sort of apologetic about the fact that we don't always run enough campaigns, as long as, if you like, we're keeping an eye on things. Somebody once remarked that journalism was, at the end of the day, a higher profession than, say, law or medicine, because journalism had both of the public interest objectives of those two noble professions, one of comforting the afflicted and the other one of afflicting the comfortable. I sometimes wonder about how important the formal media is in actually determining or helping to shape the outcome of events, and I suspect that influence is actually steadily declining. I don't think, for example, that during the Howard years, that John Howard, assiduous reader of the media though he was, ever did anything particularly to please the media or to appease it or whatnot. He used and manipulated it or whatnot, but he was essentially going over it to appeal to public opinion or to popular prejudice or whatever, rather than sort of thinking that he would square off somebody or deal with a lobby group in that way. I think the Labor Party, while again, like Howard, very focused on and insanely worried about the 24-hour news cycle at the expense of longer-term interests. I don't sort of think necessarily that the media is shaping and directing the debate as once you might have said that it did so. But I have no doubt whatever that the sort of things that the media is talking about are the real issues that are going on, and that the content that is coming out there, plus other contents coming inter alia from a whole host of new media, is, you know, still as important as ever, and that a well-informed public and popular opinion is still, if you like, the critical way in which best policies are created. My fear is, if you like, that the media is going down a wrong path in the sense that they're becoming less specialised, more interested in the unimportant and the trivial, and not focusing enough on their main functions of shining a spotlight in places that some people want to keep dark, in talking about some subjects which it really would be all too convenient that we didn't talk about, or in bringing to public attention facts that have to be considered in weighing up issues of people's rights and the right thing to do. In that respect, you know, the notion that sunlight is the best disinfectant of bad ideas The best way in which you're going to attract good ideas, I think, still prevails.
Well, this is a rare opportunity to exchange views and ideas and ask questions of Jack, who I think has traversed a very broad terrain about the role of the media. And maybe I'll ask Lainey to ask the first question, because I think you were expressing some concerns in your talk.
Thank you, Jack. So many questions, so little time. Try to find one. Maybe I'll ask the question this way, just by telling you about one of my recent experiences. In terms of papers that run particular lines, and I will just give you an example of The Australian and just hear what you have to say about that. The Australian is running a very strong line against any consultation on future development of an Australian human rights charter, to the point that they are not publishing any op-ed pieces in support of that. It's not surprising maybe that an op-ed piece I offered after they published some stuff by some stories about George Pell and Peter Jensen being very active here in Canberra against any form of consultation. I've prepared an op-ed piece that got rejected, but they did even reject an op-ed piece by Jeffrey Robertson, who was writing in support of development stuff. So, what is there that, is there anything that we can do to break into that when a paper like The Australian decides, okay, we're going to run a line on something? Is there anything we can do?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, I have no doubt The Australian broadly thinks that, and that to some extent its op-ed pages support that, although I would sort of say that over a period, I'm not going to defend them, but over a period they've run stuff on the other side of the debate. But there are many doors even into The Australian. You don't just say, I'm going to speak to the op-ed page editor. If you can't get there, you talk to the chief of staff, or you talk to people who are writing on that array of issues and whatnot. Because The Australian, deplorable as it is by world standards actually reasonably good at giving a fairly wide representation of the opinion that's about, and reporting reasonably straight what people say. I often compare it, I might say, with the Daily Telegraph in England, which, though regarded as, if you like, the paper for old Tory colonels and right-wing ranters, is probably the best paper, newspaper, for coverage of what's happening in the world, and oddly enough, what's happening in the British trade union movement. It reports them reasonably straight, if only as a foundation for kicking everything or everybody in the teeth. So you look to other doors. Likewise, this has always been the policy of the Canberra Times. One of the things that I tried very hard as an editor was to make sure that there was no monolith of opinion sort of going on there. Our arts editor might well think something about a particular thing, but if you couldn't persuade him, we had about five separate arts sections in the paper that weren't particularly controlled by the arts editor, whether or not they were daily sections or the panorama pages or whatever. There was the news pages. There are people around who are quite adept, if you like, at judging the markets. One of the things that always works best, I might say, is just reading the bylines. And what I mean by that is a person who writes about something in the paper, these days the first thing that anybody writes in the Canberra Times on a day is by Jack Waterford or something like that. What bylines when I started were virtually unknown, but people can now put bylines on weather stories. But if you ring up that person and sort of say, I see you're writing about this, did you know this, and try to sell them an angle or something like that, it is quite likely that that will be followed through. Whereas if you ring, say, the chief of staff, who may be wrestling with 20 or 30 different stories right at that particular moment and the way in which to divert resources around, you might get respectful attention, but probably not the same sort of immediate recognition that this is an issue that is important. So bear in mind that there are many, many mansions and there are many, many doors in. I might say, in relation to a question that somebody was asking before about how the Christian right and some of the new sort of Baptist-style churches and so forth are getting such a run in the papers, it's chiefly because of the professionalism, including after very extensive media training, of the way in which they operate, as well as, if you like, some evidence. I mean, their total church attendances are probably not as high as what you might call old mainstream churches, whatever, but there's some evidence, if you like, of enthusiasm, excitement or whatnot about the way in which they're gathering congregations and there. So there's, if you like, some evidence of momentum. Whereas too often in dealing with some of the more mainstream churches, there's, if you like, established adversary relationships, deep mutual suspicions, and at best sometimes a sort of a reluctant feeling that, well, I suppose I do have to speak to you jackals of the press, but, you know, I'd really rather not. Well, I'm not talking about you, but I'm thinking, I have George Pell in my mind. But, you know, if you wonder why he gets a reasonably tough time from the media, it's because he goes into it like a front row forward, kicking and punching as he goes, and he gets quite a few back in return. But by comparison, you know, some of these media savvy, new media style, enthusiastic religions are quite sophisticated in the way they approach the media, in the ways in which they, if you like, look for topical material on which they can sort of attach themselves as with Velcro or something like that and demand to be heard, and in the way in which they bombard the media with messages.